Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We see crime as something of a hybrid between the physical and digital worlds. Even if you think of a very traditional form of offending, there will be digital evidence associated with that offence almost certainly.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm David Andrews. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. Today I'm joined by Dr. Simon Walsh, Chief Scientist Forensics at the Australian Federal Police. In this capacity, he leads a critical operational support portfolio comprising the suite of AFP's forensic science and technical intelligence capabilities. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
Simon, perhaps as we start, I think it's often good to give people a bit of contextual background and explanatory detail, especially for what perhaps is a technical and detailed and little abstract to the public, that the notion of science and forensics sometimes. So perhaps if you could just start with a bit of an explanation of what your role actually entails as the Chief Scientist Forensics.
Yeah, thanks, David. Yeah, so as the Chief Scientist, I lead the AFP's Forensic Command. That's a command of around about 400 people dispersed from our headquarters and main lab here in Canberra, but through our regional headquarters that are based in most of the capital cities of Australia. And also we have a few people working as part of our international network with our foreign partners in the region and elsewhere overseas. And forensic science and the forensic capabilities within an environment like ours in the AFP are part of a group of capabilities that we sort of think of as close operational support areas. So they work in support of all of our operational work, whether that's our community policing here in the ACT or our national and international investigations that we do with partner organisations domestically or overseas. The forensic capabilities provide a support to those investigations, and they support all of the outcomes that the investigations are ultimately targeting, whether that's an arrest or a prosecution in a traditional law enforcement sense, or increasingly trying to disrupt and prevent crimes or security incidents from occurring in the first place, and contributing more into the intelligence domain and the outcomes that sort of support can provide.
And as a bit of a follow-up, I suppose, to look at the title in its whole, Chief Scientist Forensics. So is science synonymous with forensics, or what's the distinction there?
Yeah, well, I guess forensics is a discipline or an applied area of science. So science is, of course, a very broad church, and forensics in a traditional sense was referred to as science pertaining to the law. So it was thought of as when you would apply any science and technology methodologies or tools to a problem that had a legal and or security context. So that's really the way in which we think of our field. So forensic science is itself pretty broad. It can involve a large number of specialised scientific areas, from chemistry to biology to digital forensics and many others. And it also increasingly involves, use of modern technologies and capabilities that are applied elsewhere throughout, throughout the fields of science and technology.
Now, I know that there are lots of federal government departments or institutions that have a scientific aspect, so whether it's DST Group of Defence or sort of purely scientific bodies. But in that sense, is part of your work sort of general scientific research as well as then the investigative forensic side of things as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good point because I guess in order to support investigations or operational activity, and with good quality science or technical intelligence, you absolutely need to try and remain at the forefront of your field in those relevant areas. So a lot of what our experts do, and you know, and we do across commands like ours, is really a process of continuous improvement, making sure that we're engaged directly or you know in support of research and innovation activities, so that we can make the best use of modern and contemporary techniques and technologies. And we do that a lot in partnership with organisations such as those that you've mentioned. So, you know, in across the Commonwealth space, organisations like the Defence Science and Technology Group, you know, our partners in the national intelligence community, our partners obviously in the law enforcement community across state and territory jurisdictions. And increasingly, we work, you know, very, very extensively with our partners in academia and partners in industry as well.
If you'll excuse the slight sort of perhaps commercial toner of this question, I think there's a certain stereotype perhaps in the public's mind around what sort of forensics looks like. It's you know, quirky people in labs, or it's people in sort of plastic onesies and face masks dusting for fingerprints. So perhaps could you maybe look at piercing some of those misconceptions and giving us a better sense of what the scope of forensic and scientific work is in modern policing?
Yeah, no, it's certainly it's a career stream, I guess, where there is a pretty good public profile, I have to say, thanks to shows like CSI and many others. There seems to be a pretty common place where you'll see a forensic scientist appearing, you know, in the detective shows or other popular culture. I guess the main distinction in terms of myth busting some of that is often they're wearing high heels and carrying a gun and involving themselves in car chases and manhandling suspects and so on, doing the whole gamut. And that's not really part of our role description. In fact, the main difference is that we are really a kind of potpourri of deep specialisation and technical expertise. So we have a range of specialised career paths within a command like ours, and it's really how you bring those specialist, how you bring that specialist expertise together. So it's a bit more of a team of teams sort of model rather than you know, an individual with a whole range of skills and techniques at their individual disposal. So that's the main difference, I think, is that we work very much in a collaborative mode. The type of work we're involved in means that the problems we face, you know, are pretty different from one matter to the next. The tools and technologies we apply obviously are consistent and have to be highly validated and stringently calibrated so that we can rely, you know, exclusively on the results that we produce. But really the context in which we apply them changes all the time. So working collaboratively in that endeavour is really a key part of what we do. And many people are involved to get the sorts of outcomes that are needed to support any investigation.
Well, I've just got a list here in front of me of some of the scope of work that's covered by the forensics area, and just to give people out there a bit of a top level view. I mean, it's including things like, you know, digital, biological, chemical, document science, the more classic crime scene investigation, as well as biometrics, ballistics identification, audiovisual, victim identification, imagery. As well as things like chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear sort of detection and scientific work there too. So it's really a very, you know, massively expansive array of skill sets that people must have to work in this area.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do have, as I said, a lot of broad range of specialist knowledge and expertise broad range of technologies and methodologies are sort of composed within that as well. And a lot of that specialist knowledge has been developed over many years by the people themselves really committing to trying to be the best expert that they can in their chosen fields. In any one matter, it can be how those different skills, different technologies can come together and add value and impact the problem. And as we've seen, as the world changes and society changes and different problems and different priorities change with it, so our operating environment never really stays the same. So the way in which those different skills can come together, and in fact the way in which we then identify and grow new skills and capabilities is really a feature of our workplace as well, as you'd find in other specialist areas and other fields of science and technology.
Within that list, or indeed I suppose beyond it as well, but are there certain capabilities or roles that are unique to the AFP in Australia? Or perhaps to put it a different way, how does the AFP scientific and forensic capability support or complement that of the states? I mean, that's obviously the state-federal divide is a difficult one in Australian public policy, and I'm sure particularly when it comes to things like policing and exchanging of information and jurisdictions and such. So how do those parts complement in your work?
Yeah, again, it's a great question, and often we find that an organisation like the AFP, obviously people know it's a policing organisation, probably recognise the uniforms, but don't really distinguish it or don't know a great deal about what might make it different from other police organisations, and particularly those that people see more in the community in their cities and towns, which are predominantly state or territory police officers. I guess first and foremost, one of the key differences is the Commonwealth has its own Crimes Act and Criminal Code. So we're responsible as the Commonwealth Police to administer and oversight and enforce that criminal law at the Commonwealth level. So there's some differences in terms of certain crime types that are emphasised or specifically prominent within Commonwealth criminal law as opposed to state criminal law, and the way in which those laws are enforced and oversighted in our federation can also be different. So obviously a well-known perhaps example would be our work in counterterrorism, where the federal police does have and the Commonwealth does have a coordinating role in that crime type. And so there's a common way in which the AFP operates in partnership with the various state and territory police in each of the state and territory jurisdictions. And so from a forensic perspective, our role then needs to be really focused on delivering on that type of mandate. So in answer to your question, some of the key differences about our work as opposed to our state and territory counterparts is in a state and territory environment, there's usually far greater volumes of community crimes, break and enters, assaults against the person, other types of crime that people encounter in large cities and towns. In the Commonwealth space, the focus is often not so much on volume but more so on complexity, so crime types such as cybercrime, online child exploitation, counterterrorism, other national security matters are more in the domain of a Commonwealth and international policing responsibility. So our capabilities need to be able to support those sorts of investigations more as a matter of routine than a matter of exception, as they might be in a state and territory environment. So I guess in terms of capability, that often means that we need to grow and deploy capabilities in a manner that's more suited to Commonwealth crime and federal crimes. And in that context, it can be a complementary set of capabilities that state and territory police can can take advantage of in certain circumstances. So a lot of our joint work in areas like organised crime or counter-terrorism, we can bring certain capabilities to bear to support that work in partnership with our state and territory partners.
I think that complexity versus volume point you made, I think, is a really useful way of perhaps condensing that distinction, is that it's certainly not a matter of being better or worse, but just a different focus or
different emphasis. Exactly. Yep.
And you did mention some of those examples you gave just then, I think, is where we're sort of now going to slightly pivot the conversation and look at some of these new and emerging types of crime that are becoming more prevalent. We had a conversation on the podcast earlier this year with a couple of researchers, Darren Linville and Will Grant, who specialize in social media forensics. Mm. So if any listeners are interested in hearing about that in a bit more detail, then feel free to consult our archive. But their focus on social media forensics and in online disinformation. So I'm not sure if that's an area that the AFP is active in responding to, but it seems to me that the evolution of digital forensics is quite a sort of fascinating pivot from perhaps those traditional, really tangible forms of forensic science. So how has that growth of digital information and crime that either takes place online or is facilitated by electronic means, how has that changed the work of the AFP and forensics as well?
Yeah, it's completely transformed. It is, I guess, a short way to describe it. The area of digital forensics and the capabilities that support the investigation of cyber crime or technology-enabled crime is by far, and has been for some time, the fastest growing and is now really the largest contribution that our command makes across our operating environment and across the capabilities that our forensic command brings to bear. So I guess very much so now, we see crime as something of a hybrid between the physical and digital worlds. Even if you think of a very traditional form of offending, such as a crime against a person, maybe a physical and or sexually motivated offence, there will be digital evidence associated with that offence almost certainly. There's a way in which the physical and the digital worlds come together in a more sophisticated sense, often in the context of cybercrime. We're talking about offshore actors, highly sophisticated technologies, delivering often harmful effects at scale. So defrauding large numbers of individuals, for example, from a distance, enabled by, the internet and encryption and other technological features of our world. And that can then be much, very complex, complex crime types for us to investigate and pursue. So, but again, the victims of those crimes are real people, and their loss is the same as if they'd been, robbed in a more traditional sense in that context. But the crimes itself are very much more in this sort of concept of hybrid crime, where everything has a mix of the physical and the digital.
So this is possibly showing a bit of my professional background as someone that both worked in defence and sort of studies that professionally. But in that space, we talk about the nature of war remaining constant, but the character of war changing. I was wondering if that's a useful analogy for this space here, whether there's sort of the nature of policing and forensics remaining constant, but the possibly a new character in which that is applied. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that's a great framing, and I'll probably take a bit of homework away from this discussion to look into some of those themes as they apply in the defence context, because certainly, it resonates with me, because I guess policing is an old discipline. It's a traditional discipline in the form of society as we know it now. the model of policing has remained constant, and in our democracies that's a model where we police by consent of the public. The famous sort of doctrine came from the UK. It's known as the Peelian principles, where the police are the public and the public are the police. And under that model of policing by consent, our legitimacy to do the work that we do and execute the powers and authorities that police have is derived from the trust of the community. So that aspect is really universal and has been a traditional and enduring aspect of, of really how we understand and apply policing effectively in our communities. But obviously, at the moment, and over time, communities change, attitudes change, and we noticed that a lot through the period recently with the COVID pandemic. The role of police was really different in that period than what it had otherwise been, requiring the police to enforce, public health orders and engage with the community in quite a different way, on quite different grounds than had previously been the case. And we've seen some consequences for that, where along with other institutions, some of the trust and confidence as it's measured, from the community in the police, has taken a dip over those recent years. So, and obviously we've seen also, how, things like social media can allow for much greater diversity of views and attitudes to, take hold in different ways across our community than what we might have experienced before. So again, adhering to those principles and achieving those broad levels of trust and confidence across that more diverse, community environment is challenging. And so I think that, some of the put that together with, as we've described, some of the changes in the operating environment, some of the changes in, therefore, the criminal environment, and it does become a much more dynamic and much more complex environment, and therefore, to use your words, the character of what we do and how we do it is certainly evolving and will need to continually evolve.
We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
I might just note for anyone listening that this next section will probably be dealing with some relatively bleak and difficult topics. So it's that of the way in which electronic media and digital media intersects with child abuse and exploitation. Because I think that's an area that you touched on earlier, and at least as a non-expert, I feel like whenever you see articles in the newspaper about people who have been arrested for being sort of involved in child abuse, so that it's usually a phone's been found that has all this information on it, or someone's on a chat room and sort of that's often a bit of a vector for them being arrested or charged. So it seems like that's almost the default, perhaps, way in which that material is disseminated and produced. So perhaps could you elaborate a little on how the child abuse industry, I suppose it is, sort of fits within this digital media space?
Yeah, I guess it's one of the, you know, it is a difficult area for, I think, for people to, you know, to comprehend and understand. It's quite an abhorrent and horrendous area of offending, I think we all agree. And clearly one in which, unfortunately, technologies that otherwise enable and empower our industries and economies can be used, to cause, you know, great harm and disseminate this form of offending much more widely and to a scale that's now, you know, really disturbingly high across our communities. And, you know, I mean, in terms of how, you know, that environment's changed, you know, it has progressed, sadly, to levels where offending, you know, can be directed over a secure internet environment via the dark web or other forms of peer-to-peer encrypted communications. By that I mean, you know, a pedophile could direct the abuse of a child somewhere in a vulnerable part of the world and then consume, you know, the viewing of that abuse for their own pleasure. And that's the sort of thing where, you know, again, from a policing perspective, you know, these are areas that motivate us, you know, to extremely high levels. But we do face, you know, these challenges of you know, transnational syndicates of trying to work with countries and communities where, you know, some of the most vulnerable individuals and groups in the world are being exploited, often by, you know, ringleaders and offenders that live amongst us in wealthier Western countries. And from a forensic perspective, of course, the work that we need to do in these areas is itself really difficult work because to support our part of the investigative and prosecution process involves the identification and categorisation of the abuse material itself. And that nowadays is, you know, large volumes of digital media, all of which is, you know, is horrendous in nature. And I guess one of the things, going back to the discussion around, you know, the changing environment, the changing criminal environment, that the challenges, you know, us and challenges me in thinking about this sort of area is that if you think about it, you know, conceptually, we're dealing with an area where, you know, the volumes of data are massive, the ways in which that data is transmitted and shared, you know, itself is, you know, global and really broad and diverse in nature. It's enabled, as we've said, by technologies of encryption and the like. But then when we get down to it, to investigate and prosecute those matters, we'll then be facing a criminal justice environment where, you know, a single person is taken before the courts to be prosecuted against, you know, maybe a particular offence or a range of offences, each in which might have a series of proofs that need to be established. And that work can be very laborious and detailed to get to the appropriate standard that allows for, you know, those judicial environments to consider and decide upon, you know, the matters at hand. And I'm not saying that to complain about it, but just to hopefully present that contrast that on one end of the scale you've got, you know, huge volumes of data, highly sophisticated technologies, globalised syndicates and transnational offending. But at the end of it, we still have to try and support and achieve a level of detail and precision that will be required for each individual matter. And, you know, though trying to get harmony across that operating environment through to that endpoint is really challenging, and it certainly challenges not just us from a policing and forensic perspective, but it challenges our legal system in terms of their ability to keep up and work effectively, you know, against these sorts of challenges as well. You know, and it's the sort of area where, from a policy perspective, I think all parties involved will need to, again, pay continual attention to it to try and do what we can all do collectively to, you know, to minimise and reduce and eliminate this type of offending and this type of abuse.
Well, I think that actually takes us quite neatly to a question I wanted to ask, which was around the extent to which the law is keeping up with, or is indeed capable of keeping up with, the speed of both technological and criminal evolution. Because I think if we think of, say, cybersecurity, that almost seems to be not a losing battle, but a you know, a deep challenge across all levels of society, in government and private sector, for how to keep ahead of what sort of cyber criminals and organisations are doing to keep those systems secure. But in the same way, I mean, criminals aren't restricted by the bounds of the law. They are inevitably going to work as far outside them as they can to achieve their outcomes. How do you manage that challenge? I mean, are there areas that require particular reform? Are the laws actually suited to this digital age? That seems like a perennial challenge up and down the line of policy and government.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress made in these areas. I think that certainly, you know, here in Australia and working with, you know, with our, you know, with our partners across the departments in the Commonwealth and through into the, you know, the legislature itself, you know, there's been some real acknowledgement of the role, particularly that technologies and digital capabilities are playing and have played for some time. So obviously in the counterterrorism and national security space, you know, there was a range of reforms made with respect to telecommunications legislation, which allowed for, I guess, greater opportunity for us in our context to get support from industry around access to information and access to devices and to computers through warrants, obviously, as is always and appropriately the case, but in a way in which, for example, telecommunication providers could assist us in accessing information in a manner that would be better aligned to the way in which technology was being used, particularly in the national security context. That's been evolved further recently with respect to amendments in areas such as the Surveillance Legislation Amendment, Identify and Disrupt legislation, which was pretty recently enacted in the last couple of years. And that was really to help provide opportunity for another range of warrants that took account of the fact that, you know, we're talking about, you know, network infrastructure and global, you know, telecommunications and the requirement and benefit that would be there for law enforcement and national security agencies to work more effectively at that broader and higher level. And then more recently, there's been changes that enable, particularly arising out of some of our five country arrangements and the International Production Orders Scheme. But that was designed to assist and streamline the process by which, for example, telecommunications or data that people might have been generating or sharing here could be held on in storage farms or data warehouses offshore, often in our case typically in the US. So the way in which that information can be recovered and shared has been now, you know, the subject of further law reform, and they're all really essential areas of progress. But, you know, there's many others where we still need to keep working, to be honest. Some of the things that spring to mind are in areas like biometrics and identification sciences. For, you know, I was involved in that area deeply earlier in my career, and particularly around the period where we were developing legislation for things like national DNA databases. And that, you know, that period, and I'm not sure if you remember it, but it was certainly a period of real growth and expansion in terms of how forensic science could contribute to investigations, particularly high volume crimes such as residential and commercial burglary and stolen motor vehicles and the like. But the legislation and the policy discussion around that time was also quite controversial because it was to do with, you know, governments holding large quantities of genetic information from their citizens. So a lot of discussion around, you know, rights and protection and privacy of that information. But that process occurred in the late 90s, early 2000s, and largely speaking, hasn't really been revisited from a legislative perspective, other than some periodic review in the first, you know, say 5 years or so of those models being in place. So there's a range of ways in which we now have either opportunity or need to use modern genetic and DNA profiling technologies, and that's another area where I'd certainly say there'd be benefit in refreshing the public policy discussion and looking at whether or not our legislation is match fit in those areas for the types of techniques and technologies that are available to us. And a great example of that is the use of genealogy databases, which is been quite prominent already in an investigative sense internationally and domestically. Great outcomes in resolving some historic and cold case matters, but it is also accessing publicly available DNA and other genealogy information. And we haven't had a public policy discussion really about how best we could use those sorts of technologies or capabilities from a law enforcement or national security perspective.
Well, it's certainly one of those areas that feels like, you know, we can see the benefits from a policing or sort of national security standpoint, as well as some of the obvious challenges and sort of, you know, liberalism and freedom aspects around people's ability to maybe not have that information on a database somewhere or how that might be misused in context. But I think that doesn't mean that there's not room for a conversation, but it just points, I think, to the complexity of that field and the need then for a conversation in how to play that out. And maybe sort of the irreverent example that jumped to mind while you're speaking is things like Ancestry.com, that people are actually voluntarily giving up a lot of their information to private companies to do goodness knows what with. And I think the number of people that actually read terms and conditions on any website is probably vanishingly small, and I'd be surprised if that was much different on some of these websites. But it's something that we should maybe be cautious of before we start giving that away, and whether that then feeds into a wider public conversation, as you say, perhaps there's a precedent there to think of.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And these areas, you know, we're exploring new technologies in respect of things like DNA profiling, and you know, we put media releases out if we, you know, do some research that we think is going to be relevant, or introduce some capability that we think is relevant, because we want to try and ensure that the public is aware of the sorts of technologies and capabilities that we're interested in or that we're applying in these areas, because we know there is a high level of public interest, and there is that balance that will need to be struck around the context in which those technologies are best applied, so that everyone's reassured that they're there to be used in circumstances, you know, where they're needed to investigate and resolve you know, complex matters of a crime or security dimension. But also that people understand, you know, the ways in which that is to happen and the legal frameworks under which that happens. And, yeah, it is hard for all of those frameworks to keep up with the pace of technological change and, you know, and that's the reality. It's been in place for a while, and it's certainly occurring now, in fact probably exacerbated in a lot of areas just via that pacing problem and the pace of change.
So one area that I think is worth sort of teasing out a little bit is the extent to which the work in the forensic space is preventative or proactive rather than responsive. And I think, again, if we're thinking of broad stereotypes, it's people coming to the scene of a crime and working out, all right, well, how's this occurred, who's responsible, and sort of working backwards. But what had struck me were some examples where there have been a bit more proactive work in policing, particularly around targeting encrypted platforms used by criminal networks, whether that's the Anom situation of 2021, which is between the FBI and Australian authorities, or EnroChat back in 2020, which was between the French and Dutch and more European-focused context. But, is there an emphasis increasingly on that sort of proactive work, or is that just part and parcel of the pace of policing work?
No, it's an excellent point, and it's absolutely there's a huge emphasis on working that way and a huge need to do so. I guess, you know, as you've said, traditionally forensic science was very much, in fact, our doctrine used to refer to things like after the fact. It was very much a response model. So a crime had occurred, someone had been harmed or murdered or worse, and it was our role to then try and recreate the events that surrounded that particular incident and provide support to the subsequent investigation and or prosecution. And that's still very much a core part of our value proposition. That's really always going to be the case. But obviously, in areas such as national security, when you're talking about offence types like terrorism, we don't want those events to happen and then be asked to come and pick up the pieces. We want to stop them from happening entirely. So the emphasis operationally has increasingly had to become more focused on disruption, so disrupting the way in which criminal syndicates or other actors go about their offending, particularly if they're organised actors in the organised crime space or, again, the terrorism space, where they're complex networks of criminal activity, and disruption strategies are designed to frustrate the ability of those networks to operate effectively and thereby reduce their effectiveness and reduce, therefore, their harm and impact on our communities. Or the ideal situation is a prevention outcome where we can harden our environment to such a degree that that offending is rendered ineffective, essentially, and doesn't occur. And from a forensic perspective, we've absolutely been on that journey. We embraced that opportunity, and necessarily so, because it was such a priority of our operational arm of the AFP and our other partners. And if we weren't actually embracing that, then we weren't really relevant to those outcomes that were being pursued in terms of disruption and prevention. So some classic ways in which that occurs is that we now practice a distinct area of intelligence, of criminal intelligence, we refer to as forensic intelligence. So information that we derive through the sorts of capabilities that we have can be really valuable in terms of contributing to the intelligence domain. So it might be that patterns of offending can be elaborated by forensic tracers, which, if you weren't approaching the aggregation and analysis of the traces that we collect in the various areas we support investigations, then you might miss that opportunity to derive that sort of intelligence outcome. It can also be that our knowledge of tactics and techniques applied in, say, for example, in the national security space, by doing the forensic work we do, we can also help to inform the preventative security layer, for example, with respect to transport security or chemicals of security concern and those sorts of policy and regulatory actions that can be implemented to harden the environment and effectively reduce risk and prevent offending. And then in the example you mentioned with respect to encrypted communications, I mean, we've talked about it a couple of times already through this discussion, but it's such an enabler of offending that if people feel that they can communicate securely, then it facilitates their business model quite significantly. And the example which we referred to as Operation Ironside, you know, was one of the most satisfying operational activities, I think, for many of us to be associated with, where essentially we were able to control and view the messaging and content that was coming across an encrypted communication platform, and through that really establish and then substantially disrupt the ways in which, you know, a large number of criminals and networks were involved in a whole range of offending. Domestically here, it was huge volumes of drug trafficking, firearms trafficking, you know, actual, you know, attempts at murder or other physical harm being disrupted, and, many hundred individuals ultimately being arrested and facing hundreds or thousands of various offences with respect to that. So, you know, that's an example of us getting smarter, us thinking about the business model and the way in which criminal groups go about their offending, and using our skills in technical and other areas to effectively disrupt that.
Well, perhaps turning to you personally, Simon, and your career and your history in the AFP. So I know that the AFP plays a large role in supporting international engagement and overseas contingencies and such as well, and that you've personally worked on a number of different disaster victim identification operations, some, you know, very prominent examples, including the Christchurch earthquake in 2011, MH17 in 2014, and we're shortly coming up on the 21st anniversary of the Bali bombings as well. So perhaps just as we close our conversation here, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your experience on these operations and perhaps in that sense how the AFP's forensics capability contributes to Australia's international presence and reputation, whether that's through creating a more secure region or through, you know, diplomacy and training up other police forces.
Yeah, no, of course. It's I think if starting at a high level, and even going back to where we started the conversation, you know, we were talking about an area of science or specialisation. Each of us have worked to develop our skills and knowledge in these areas of interest and passion, but ultimately to apply them then into a set of circumstances where we think there's real value. And I suppose for me personally, those circumstances, such as the ones you've mentioned, where a profound incident has occurred and affected very significantly large numbers of individuals, and our community more broadly, I suppose from my personal perspective, if there's something I can do to assist with the way in which the individuals involved, the communities directly or indirectly involved, can start to respond, to that, what's often quite a cataclysmic and unprecedented set of circumstances, and start to bring a little bit of, or answer some questions, bring bring some closure, I guess, as sometimes said, to the matters at hand, then that's, absolutely where, from my perspective, I always wanted to be, and others would say the same, no doubt. From a practical perspective in terms of, what that's like, I guess, you know, these are large scale, multi-agency, multinational sort of environments. So one of the things that's always been really key and critical in that circumstance, and it's something that Australians and across, you know, my experience working in this area, but particularly at the Commonwealth level, I think Australians have built such a great reputation for genuine assistance and genuine partnership, particularly in our region, but elsewhere across the world as well. And, you know, that's sort of been really evident in many of these significant examples, where, you know, our neighbours in many circumstances have faced a terrible challenge and needed support and assistance. And Australia has been a country that they've looked to in those circumstances to ask and provide that assistance. For us personally, obviously, you know, where we've had many of our own citizens, family members impacted by those disasters, you know, there's a huge emphasis and importance, you know, for us to ensure that the investigation, you know, the identification, you know, the repatriation, you know, of those individuals is done as quickly and as effectively and as professionally and to the appropriate standard, you know, as it must be. So I guess we have that dual benefit of providing some of those answers and some of that support to our communities here, but also able to build on that reputation and that genuine sense of partnership that Australia is well known for, particularly reaching out into our region and providing that support, you know, to our partner countries and partner organisations in that context as well. So it's difficult work. There's no two ways about it. Every time those circumstances, you know, come about, you know, it's there's a whole order of, you know, of complexity and chaos. But I guess for people like me and organisations like ours and those of other partner agencies, you know, in our community here and across the world, you know, that's the job that we're here to do, is to try and go forth in those circumstances and bring a bit of order into those chaotic situations and start to handle those matters in a way that, yeah, that supports what needs to be supported, and particularly foremost in those sorts of circumstances is, you know, is to answer the questions that the next of kin and others have, and to provide, you know, their loved ones, you know, back to them as quickly and in the right way as possible.
Well, I think we'll leave it there, but Dr. Simon Walsh, thank you so much for your time on the National Security Podcast. That was a really wide-ranging and fascinating conversation about all matters, police, science, forensics and more. So thank you again for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thanks for the invitation.